Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Lauer Editorial Review. The Lauer is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. The Lauer is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Lauer and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 112 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Lauer and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Lauer and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on rationing when we come back. Now, let me ask you this. What do you think's wrong with the Ten Commandments? Well, it's pretty obvious that something is wrong with the Ten Commandments because they've been banned from our public schools, banned from our public institutions, and now banned from our national consciousness. And now, instead of these 10 simple time-tested laws, we see the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in their place. And they teach the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto in our schools, our public institutions. We've made them a part of our national psyche. And I contend that this is a radical change in our political and moral outlook over the past 50 years. Are you aware, for instance, that your daughter couldn't receive an aspirin in your public school without your consent? But your daughter can have an abortion arranged through that same public school nurse without even your knowledge, much less your consent. That's why I contend that the solution to this moral perversion and national insanity is to go back to what worked. Let's go back to the Ten Commandments and the Mosaic Law. You know, our founding fathers practiced and they advocated the Ten Commandments. They even put 22 principles of that law into our federal constitution. And there's still at least one school left in America that teaches this entire Mosaic Law, the Ten Commandments, and all 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments, as well as the penalties, and the 33 benefits that we all receive for their observance. Now, you know, every law has a penalty, and you don't have to know what the penalty is to suffer from its effects. So whether you call this the Mosaic Law, the Law of God, the Common Law, Natural Law, or Karma, or something else, it's automatic, and it works just like AIDS, herpes, and VD, which are the natural penalties for adultery. Now, if you'd like more information, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package? That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general, and it's an educational, informative, and entertaining part of your life, and best of all, it's free of charge. Doesn't cost anything. And you can call and order one right now, and the number to call is 417-273-4967. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click on the email, and then send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember that name and number again is georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now while you're thinking about it before you forget. All right, last time I said we'd take a look at rationing in World War II. Well, rationing in wartime Germany, I've got an article here, deals a little bit about this thing of rationing in the totalitarian countries. Now, over here on our side of the border, you know, we saw ourselves as being a friendly Joe Sixpack chewing gun. And then on the other side were these dirty, rotten, low-down, no-good Gestapo guys over here that were just killing people right and left, mass murderers, and so on. Well, the people in those countries, behind Nazi occupation and in Japan and so on, those people also had rationing, totalitarian rationing, which is a more severe form of rationing. In fact, it was so bad, and it was so austere, that rationing on our side of the border was nothing compared to what it was on the other side of the border. I mean, by comparison, it was just nothing. Now, the difference, I think, this time around is going to be that communism tends to dictatorship. Communism lends itself easily to this whole concept or this plan or program of totalitarian government. Well, just take a look around the world. Every place that they practice communism, you stand in line and share the shortage, and then they have these autocratic governments like you see in China and Russia. And now we're beginning to see it in Venezuela. See, they just had this Venezuelan guy. His name is, Chavez. And he's a socialist. See, he's actually, it doesn't make any difference whether you call a guy socialist, a communist, or a fascist, or a capitalist. You know, they all boil down to the same thing. And here's what this boils down to. And Americans are all communists. I mean, it's let's be pragmatic and logical, intelligent people. Take a look at our society today. Do we practice public school? Boys and girls, everybody practices public schools, and your presidential candidates are not suggesting to you that we dismantle and abandon the public school system, which is the 10th plank to the Communist Manifesto. And all of your presidential candidates are in favor of the income tax, which is the second plank to the Communist Manifesto. So whether they're Republicans or Democrats, whether they are communists or socialists, or whether they're fascist or, you know, hang a label on it, none of those people are opposed to the income tax or central banking. Do you know of any country or any block of countries that are supposed to and wants to abolish central banking, fiat currencies, paper money, and go back to gold and silver? Have you heard anything like that, any debates? Hell, that isn't even on the radar screen. Anybody wants to abolish the Federal Communications Commission or the Department of Transportation? Have you heard anything like that? No. All 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto are in full force and effect in the United States, and all Americans practice it. All Americans are in favor of it. And communism lends itself to rationing and stand in line and share the shortage. Now, that being the case, that's not going to change. I'm not going to change all of you people out there by coming on the air and saying, did you know you're a practicing communist and you're going to have to stand in line and share the shortage? Hell, that's not going to change any of you Barney, Sesame Street, Mr. Rogers people. Communism is the only thing you know. You couldn't practice the Ten Commandments. None of you people out there could practice the Mosaic Law. You cannot practice the Bill of Rights to the American Constitution. Hell, you don't even know what they are. So I would submit to you that you're not going to be a very prime candidate now for practicing the Ten Commandments. You couldn't find them. I'll bet you that if I said to you, show me in the Bible where the Ten Commandments are located. There's two places. Two. Show them to me. I'll bet you that 99% of you Christians out there couldn't find the Ten Commandments in the Bible with both hands on a road map at high noon with a... No, could you? Could you? The answer is hell no, you couldn't. All right, now you can forget about practicing the Ten Commandments. That ain't going to happen. Now, if you don't practice the Ten Commandments, you're not going to have an abundance. You're going to have rationing. That's the purpose for this week's program, this week's series. It's get ready for rationing because it's coming to a city near you. Now, I'm not getting ready for rationing. I'm not going to get a ration card. I'm going to continue to practice the Ten Commandments. I'm going to practice abundance. I'm not going to practice rationing. I'm not going to stand in line with the rest of you people to get my pair of shoes. I've already got my pair of shoes. I'll take care of my own shoe needs. Thank you. And it's good that I do that. Don't get mad at me now. It's good. Because, you see, every time there's a George Gordon, it takes all of the pressure off of you people. Because all of us that are practicing abundance, all of us that are practicing the Ten Commandments, we're not in the line with you people. We are not sharing the shortage with you. Think of it. You know, every pair of shoes that comes out is one less pair of shoes for you people to share. Hell, I've got my own shoes. I don't need to stand in line and take yours. So I'm not even going to do that. Now, I'm suggesting that two or three others out there think about this, because it lends itself to totalitarianism, and that's what they had over in Germany. They had a totalitarian government. Now, I suspect that we're going to have that totalitarian government here in the United States. I've said before, I'm going to say it again, I will be amazed if there's an election this coming November. I don't think George Bush is going to leave the White House. But then I didn't think Bill Clinton was going to leave the White House. I thought Bill Clinton was going to do it. Now, I don't know who's going to take over the reins of government as the American dictator, but it's coming, and coming to a city near you shortly. I suspect it's George Bush. Hell, if it's not George, then it'll be Brock or somebody else. Now, recycling in Germany began to be officially encouraged already in the years before the war, connected with the successive aiming at the enforced development of industries useful for war. The purpose of recycling was to save money, otherwise spent upon imports of raw materials. The German currency was not convertible. Uh-oh. See this convertibility of the currency? That's important. And that's what we saw earlier in the week with Zimbabwe. See, their currency isn't convertible. And because of that, they can't just print this money up and send it off to Saudi Arabia and buy a boatload of oil, because the Saudis won't take it. Well, before World War II, people around the world were not taking German marks. Now, in the first line that was collected, there were metals. And not only iron, but particularly rarer metals, such as copper. Old clothes were collected for their fiber. Meat bones, as purchased with meat from the butcher, were collected to make soap from. And I remember a verse made as a parody upon a song chanted by the girls from the BDM. And at the same time, the public was encouraged to save on food during the war, then the analogous action to save on charcoal, to exercise modesty at least once a week. Families should eat a meal which could be prepared by making use of only one pot, vegetables, beans, with potatoes. And generally, the use of butter was discouraged in favor of margarine. And I remember the slogan, taken presumably from one of the speeches of Goebbels or Goring. All right, now, they're going to encourage you to use margarine. This margarine, by the way, just to pass this on to you, in order to make it spreadable, they put little plastic balls in them. And margarine is homogenized to start with. That's the bad cholesterol. You know, that's the triglyceride stuff, the bad stuff. So I would avoid, if it was up to me, I would avoid margarine and artificial spreads. In fact, when it comes to oil, I think that you should zero in on olive oil. Now, there's about 10 or 15 different kinds of oil, but they're all pricey. The cheap oils are killers. If it's cheap, it's going to kill you. If it's expensive, it's probably good for you. Now, there's cold-pressed walnut oil, peanut oil, olive oil, grapeseed oil, pumpkin seed oil. There's oil made out of all the seeds that are out there. They're a little pricey. And I'm not suggesting that you spend all your money on oil, but you got to have your cooking oil in ahead of time. And if you want to have butter, you need to have a cow. You need a cow. So be thinking about that, moving out into the countryside and getting yourself a cow up front and in advance. Because once the rationing program is put into play, once the dictatorial government is put into place, it's god-awful hard to make moves. Moving from the city to the country under a dictatorial form of government is going to be very, very tricky. Whereas you could do it today, it's not all that big a deal, but, you know, other than psychological. So the Germans then were encouraged to get off of butter and get on to margarine. Well, that wasn't good for their health. Now, the rationing began immediately with the war's outbreak in September of 1939. For every person, there was rationing cards for general foodstuffs, meat and its products such as sugar, meat, noodles, whatever an N-U-D-L-E-S is in Germany, fat such as butter, margarine, oil, tobacco products. All right, now I'm not a smoker, I used to be, but let me tell you, if I was a smoker, I think I'd have a 4-year supply of tobacco laid away. And if you vacuum pack it, you know, put it in quart jars and vacuum pack it, you can probably maintain the moisture, and if you store it down in your basement, you might be able to keep that tobacco for, you know, some time. Now, I used to be a nicotine addict, so I understand what your dilemma is. I think you'd be better served if you got off of tobacco altogether, because tobacco does not store well, doesn't keep well. It's bad for your health. There's 15 reasons why you ought to avoid it. But, you know, if you can't, well, then you better make sure that you got some stockpile, because you're going to be standing in line with the rest of the communists sharing the shortage. The tobacco products distributed, I think, every other month or so. And there was an annual ration card for clothes and shoes. Now, in Iraq, they had rationing. Under Saddam Hussein, they had a ration program. Now, the cards were printed on strong paper containing numerous small subdivisions marked and imprinted with their value, from 5 g butter to 100 grams of butter. Every acquisition of the ration of goods required the appropriate marking. And should you wish to eat a certain soup at a restaurant, the waiter might take out a pair of scissors and cut off one of your 5 g butter subdivisions, the required items and amounts listed on the menu. All right, so you'll have rationing in your restaurants as well. Now, that isn't to say that very many of you people are going to be eating in the restaurants. When rationing comes into vogue, there's shortages of everything everywhere. And in Zimbabwe, the unemployment rate's 80%. So the 20% are the government workers that are out there working, or government contractors. Now, of course, those are the top feeders. And if you're in that group, you're in Fat City. But if you're down here at the bottom, 80% of the feeders down here, you're probably not going to be eating in very many restaurants. But if perchance you do, you're going to have your ration card. So where does that leave George Gordon? Well, hell, when I go into the restaurant, I won't be able to get those things that are rationed, like meat, milk, butter, and eggs. I don't know what I'm going to eat when I go to the restaurant, because you're going to have your ration card. Now, in the evening, the shop owner would then spend an hour at least grueling and gluing the collected marking onto large sheets of paper, which he had to hand in to the appropriate authorities. Charcoal for heating was rationed by the household. The amounts attributed under rationing were sufficient to live from, but they clearly did not permit any luxuries. Whipped cream became unknown from 1939 until 1948, as chocolate, cakes with rich creams, meat, of course, which could be eaten every day. The amounts did differ, not only for children and grown-ups. People doing physically exhausting work received cards with larger attributions. Other items were not rationed, but simply became unavailable, as they would have had to be imported from overseas. Coffee, in particular, which throughout the war was replaced by substitutes made from roasted grains. Now, here in the United States, to this day, we still have these roasted grain coffees, fake coffees like Postum and Perro, things like that. Actually, they're kind of tasty. Now, we use that Postum and Perro here in our home more often than coffee. But again, if you like coffee and you're addicted to nicotine for say and your cigarettes or your caffeine in your coffee, you better be thinking ahead, because when the rationing comes, like in Germany, they didn't even ration coffee. That's because there wasn't any. You didn't need to ration it because there was zero coffee available, period. So I imagine bananas were probably unknown. So while the German U-boats were sinking all of the British shipping, you can rest assured that there wasn't any transport ships coming in from Brazil into Germany. So, tropical fruits were probably unheard of. Now, there might have been some tropical fruits that were coming up through Italy into Europe, in the early part of the war, maybe bananas from North Africa or something. I don't know exactly what they did or didn't have. But keep in mind that the things that are coming in from overseas are going to be a very, very short supply. So oranges, unless you live in California, oranges in North Dakota will become probably non-existent. The people in California are going to eat all their own oranges. They won't need to be shipping any. So going on here, Coca-Cola had been imported before the war, though children were told not to drink it as it was considered not healthy. And also that disappeared. And when at about 1950, I drank it for the first time again, it still had precisely the same taste as more than 10 years before. So there was no rationing of potatoes, vegetables, and local fruit. There was rationing, or it was practically unheard of, to see whipped cream, chocolate, meat, cake, coffee, Coca-Cola, and bananas. They were just unheard of. Not rationed were potatoes, vegetables, and local fruit. Imported citrus fruits were rare. Bananas were, again, unavailable. In more rural areas, farmers continued to bring their products to the markets. Large cities depended on long-distance delivery. So if you're living in the city, this is a problem. This is why I said better off to get out into the countryside. and to start planting Victory Gardens. Now, for you people, if you've decided you're going to hole up in the city, and a lot of you have decided to do that, subsistence and survival in the city is not unheard of. And that's where the Victory Gardens came in. Now, I've mentioned this before, so let me mention it again, because I think it's very important. You need 2,000 square feet for a family of six with French intensive culture. And you can feed a family of six on 2,000 square feet. You don't need 2 acres, you need 2,000 square feet. Now, that's about let's take 6.5 times 60 times 6 is 2,340. Now, I've got six raised beds down here. Those six raised beds are encircled with railroad ties. They're 8 inches deep, and they have 8 inches of dirt in them. And they're 6.5 by 60 feet long, and I got six of them. There's 2,340 square feet. I can feed six people year-round off of those six beds. And you can do it in Austin, Texas, or Cleveland, Ohio, or you can do it in Poughkeepsie, New York. Now, the further north you go, the tougher it gets. Now, keep in mind that out in the countryside, the farmers will be encouraged to produce. And they will probably be given X-ration cards to get all the gasoline they need to produce. They won't have gasoline now to run up and down the roads, but they'll have gasoline on their farms to produce cherries. And if you're out in the countryside, you're in a better position to produce your own and to buy from the local farmers around you or to trade with them. Now, once the farmer produces his crop, he has to sell it to the government. Now, that's what happened in Germany in World War II. Now, Nick Mingelin, I'll tell you the Mingelin story here. He was in Holland in 1940. And when the Germans came into Holland in 1940, they took over Holland in 3 weeks. Short, direct war, just it's all over. Now, Nick's parents took him out from Amsterdam, they were city dwellers, and they took him out onto the family farm, to his uncle's farm. And Nick spent the war out there from 1940, 41, 42, 43, and until September of 44 out there, until after the war, as a matter of fact, and into 46 and 47. But the Germans were driven out in September of 1944 out of Holland. And so the rationing that went on there was that the farmers had to sell all of their food to the government, all of their produce. Now, they had all they wanted. So Nick said that they had all of the potatoes, all the cabbages, all the meat, milk, butter, and eggs, and chickens, and everything that they wanted. You want honey? You need some beehives. Now, when they went to sell that, they could not sell that because that was black marketeering. I'm going to tell you a little story here. There was a guy, Nick told me about, that broke the window out of a delicatessen in the little village that was close by their farm. And they caught the guy. And what he'd done is he broke the window out and he stole a salami or a sausage. And they found him. They caught him. They took him down in front of the store, made him kneel down in front of all the people in the village. And this German officer came over and shot this guy in the back of the head and killed him right there on the street, right in front of the delicatessen. Now, this is what totalitarian governments do. They've got the power to do it, and so they just do it. The objective is to show everybody in the community, every citizen here, that if you break the window out of the delicatessen and steal a salami, we will kill you if we catch you. Then they left his body in front of the store for 3 days. Now, can you imagine what that body looked like after 3 days with maggots crawling all over? I mean, that's just the natural process. And then after 3 days, they allowed him to clean up the body and go on with business. Now, that's the kind. Now, and I asked Nick, I said, how many more break-ins to the delicatessen were there? He said, none. Zero. That's why I mentioned to you the other day, I said, now, if you want to stop illegal immigration across the border, you just go down there, and every time you catch an illegal coming across the border, you shoot him right there in the desert, lay him rot right there. Let the buzzards, the coyotes, and the maggots eat him. How many will you have to kill? All to a 300? Probably. Is that kind and gentle? No. And is it effective? Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, we Americans don't have the stomach for doing that, but I'm gonna tell you that there are people out there that do. And the gangsters, the thugs that are now operating under Homeland Security here in the United States, the people who were raised on Barney, Sesame Street, and Mr. Rogers, those people will do what they're told, and they will do it when they're told to do it. And when they're told to kill you, they will kill you, and they won't even have any compunctions. None. So I'm asked a lot of times, you mean to tell me you think Americans will kill Americans? Yeah, there's no doubt in my mind. None. And that's because America's youth has been educated to become communists. The God of America is the United States government. And anybody that's out of step with the United States government is now a terrorist. We hang labels on them, you know, like homophobic and racist and cultist and terrorist. See, and these words are politically incorrect. And so as a matter of political correctness, in order for you to maintain your political correctness, you'll follow your government's instructions. When they say kill, you'll kill. Little doubt in my mind. Now, totalitarianism is coming to America, and this is why living in the city is a bad place to live, because in the city, you've got to have order. I mean, it just isn't any other way around it. Out here in the country, we don't have to have order. It isn't important out here in the country, but order in the city is crucial. The thing can't work without it. So, you know, today, you people living in the cities, you've got these marauding gangs running around and raising hell with you and one thing and another. You can rest assured that when the totalitarian government takes over, that'll be a thing of the past. Unless it's unleashed by the government itself, there won't be any marauding gangs. And you saw that with Hurricane Katrina. Hurricane Katrina. Right after that, there were some marauding gangs. They went into the car lots and they stole, there was one gang, about six or eight black youths in a stolen Cadillac automobile. And they were driving around, they're all armed, kind of like, you know, you see these thugs in Mogadishu, you know, in Somalia and so on. Just black thugs driving around with guns. And so they needed to put an end to it. So I forgot who it was now. It was some law enforcement agency, I don't know if it was the FBI or somebody. They caught the car with the eight thugs. They killed all of them right there on the spot. So when they got through with the enterprise, there were just eight dead bodies and a shot-up stolen Cadillac. But it stopped all of the hooliganism in New Orleans. Not the looting that occurred right up front. I'm talking about, you know, a couple weeks later when these thugs, these bands. Now, you have to do that because you've got this crisis circumstance. It's a crisis condition. And if you're going to live in the city, then you're going to have to get along with everybody else. You're going to have to be able to practice triage. You're going to have to live in a totalitarian society inside your cities. So get used to it. If that's where you want to hole up for the duration, okay. But when the policeman says, stand still, come here, go there, stand up, sit down, shut your mouth, and do what you're told. Because if you don't, he's going to kill you. Now, it won't take very many deaths for most of you Barney Sesame Street kids to figure this out. And you're going to cry. You're going to gnash your teeth. You people, you know, who do not have the stomach for this kind of thing, you're going to be horrified. But then that's the way life is. Life is filled with horrors, and they're coming to a city near you. Hey, I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard in more than 112 countries daily worldwide over the Internet and radio. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, it's eight schools and all. The Law School is a private, nonprofit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives, all of which can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about rationing here. Rationing in a totalitarian environment in the city is going to be hell. It's going to be hell. It's not that you can't survive it. And it's that the police and the public officials don't have time to dink around with you. And that's because there's just a damn many people running around in the city, and all of these people have to be served by rationing and ration cards. And as a result of that, they have to get the food someplace, so they have to get it from the farmer. So now if you're a farmer, you're going to stand a greater chance and have a lot greater latitude. And that's because farmers are necessary and imperative. Farmers. And that's because they're the guys that produce the food. Soldiers don't produce any food. Industrial workers don't produce any food. They're all dependent. And so the few farmers that you have left in America, I mean, those guys are going to be like gold. I mean, I've said this before. The first thing you want to do when this thing turns turtle is go capture an Amish man. That's the guy you want. Get an Amish man. Because that guy's the only guy that was on a farm, or one of the few. Now, that being the case, then, if you're out in the countryside, you got a few acres, and you're a farmer, you're going to have better access to ration cards, better access to goods and services, and you're going to have better access to food, clothing, and the necessities, because you're a needed or a necessary part of society. An industrial worker in the city is an expendable commodity. And in the last program, I said, if you're in the city and you're 85, you know, it's about, you know, five or six or eight items, and you got medical problems, you know, just pass, you know, over 85, critical injuries, crashes, shootings, older than 60, mental impairment, Alzheimer's disease, chronic disease, advanced heart failure, lung disease, poorly controlled diabetes, write her off. You people are just dead. Out in the countryside, with those same disabilities, you know, with your own piece of ground, you know, there's a better chance that you'll be able to survive that. Now, if you're 30 years old, industrial worker living in the city, you're going to be rationed. You're not going to have a very good lifestyle, but you're going to have enough, because government needs you to continue working, doing what you're doing to produce the scarce and needed foreign exchange. to bring in hard currency so that we can buy the shortage items that are short. Now, if government has to choose between cluster bombs and bananas, what do you think they're going to choose? If your government in Washington, D.C. has to choose spending money on food coming in from Latin America, you know, such as papayas, mangoes, you know, those luxury tropical fruits and cluster bombs, what do you think they're going to choose? I mean, it's a no-brainer. And so like in Nazi Germany, they don't need to ration it because it isn't going to be available, period. Now, if you're in the city and you get caught hoarding, if you get caught in this black market environment, they're going to come down on you hard and heavy. If you're out in the countryside and you're practicing the free marketplace, like you're producing cherries and fruits and stuff like that, and you're trading it to your neighbors for meat, milk, butter, and eggs, no problem out there in the countryside. It's when you sell the stuff and you get caught selling that stuff to city people. Oh, God help you. God help you. Because now you're a black marketeer. And in a totalitarian regime, God knows what they're going to do to you, getting caught doing it. So you're going to have to watch that. But trading out here with your neighbors for other foods, in other words, maybe you don't have cows. You know, maybe you've got sheep. And you're trading sheep meat for cow meat with your neighbor Dale. That's not a problem. And Nick Minglin reported on that in Nazi-occupied Germany. Well, it was in Holland. I asked him about that. I said, well, did the German authorities come out? No. No, he said he never saw. The Germans don't come out here to the farms knocking on your doors. They do that in the cities. It's in the city that they're out knocking on your doors. It never happened out in the countryside. Now, when you took your produce into the village and you went to sell it, you had to sell it to the German authorities. And you got paid in German marks, a German occupation currency, which you then had to take out. Now, if you wanted to buy a new tractor, you wanted to buy tires, hell, the German government, they're not dumb. They'd give farmers the tires and gasoline, everything they needed to run their tractors and do what they needed to do to produce more food. Food is a very important commodity in war, very important commodity when it's being rationed. Farmers are at the top of the heap. That's why I keep telling you people, get the hell out of the city and get out on the farm. That's the place you want to be. But for you people that are going to hold up in the city now, it's going to be tough. And so you might as well get used to the idea that there's going to be some shortages and you're not going to have this stuff unless you've got it stockpiled in advance. Now let's try this stockpiling in advance. That's not hoarding. What you produce yourself isn't hoarding. So if you're producing, let's say you've got a victory garden in your front lawn, you tear up your yard and you put in beets and carrots and tomatoes and peppers and stuff like that, and then you can 100, 200, 300 jars of food and you put it on your shelf, that's not hoarding. That's home canning. That's what you prepared. Here's another one. When you've got canned goods beyond the expiration date, that's not hoarding. Don't be concerned about having 200 cans of coffee. Hell, those are old cans of coffee. What you need to be concerned about, if they catch you with 200 new cans of coffee and you've got a ration book that allows you to have a can of coffee a month, oh, I don't know what they might do to you. You know, today they give you a fine and dink around with you, but in a totalitarian society, 200 cans of coffee, and you're caught, and then especially if you get caught selling that stuff. When these totalitarian authorities tell you don't sell cocaine on the streets, when they catch you selling cocaine, they will administer curbside court. They'll shoot you in the back of the head and let your body repose there for 3 days as a warning to everybody else that's dealing with Joe, the cocaine broker. I mean, that's just where reality's at. That goes on in the cities. It doesn't go on in the countryside. It could, and probably did, but it's not common. So beginning with 1939, going back to Germany now, beginning with 1939, automobiles required a special permit to be driven, not made noticeable by a bright red V-like angle on their license plate. Private cars did not obtain this permit, except for a few physicians, delivery vans, and trucks. They received it, and they had no noticeable difficulty to obtain the necessary gasoline or petrol. And also, the better private cars soon were confiscated by the military and the public authorities and then reappeared as transportation for generals. Still, as the war proceeded, efforts were made to fuel engines, not with gasoline, but with gas emanating from glooming wood, and there appeared trucks with man-high cylinders behind their cabins, being the kilns into which the driver from time to time had to fill more wood chips. Now, travel by rail was under no restrictions to the general public, and the resorts operated and were frequented as they had been in peacetime. Although after 1941, a number of pensions and small hotels were set aside for use of the program, named KLV, the Kinder something rather here. This at first was destined to provide organized, publicly financed vacations for children from large industrial cities like Berlin. But by then, the air raid spread, and in larger towns, school was interrupted daily by retreating into shelters. And so... entire classes together with some of their teachers were sent to these resort villages located in non-industrial areas and unlikely to be the aims of bombing attacks. Now, along with depression, you know, we're heading into a depression, and along with that will come war. It's just inevitable. So with the wars, then comes future, you know, exacerbated shortages. So you got shortages that are exacerbated by trade problems, and then you get war, and then the shortages are exacerbated by the war. Now, some things won't even be rationed. Now, I'm suspecting, or I expect, that we're going to have massive famine here in the United States and cannibalism. And I got that from Deuteronomy chapter 28, so let me flip over to that one for you quickly. And I think it's going to be worse here in the United States, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand because we didn't get ours in World War II. But here's what we can expect, the Great Tribulation. So that a man, here it is, that, and you shall eat the fruit of your own body, the flesh of your sons and of your daughters, which the Eternal your God has given you, in the siege and in the straitness wherewith thine enemy shall distress you. So the siege, that is the Iranians and the Middle Easterners, the Arabs, the Muslims, they're going to put an embargo on selling oil to the United States. This is going to cause a great disruption in our economy. And as a result of that, we won't be able to get oil. Then we'll have to launch wars in order to get that oil. The Arabs over there now are taking our worthless paper. And then the Arabs are saying, well, give us something. Well, we don't have something to give them. And so when we don't give them, we don't pay them. They're going to shut off the oil. When they shut off the oil, we have to go to war to get the oil. When we go to war, that creates a tussle, disrupts our economy even further. And I suspect that probably even World War III will probably be an outgrowth from it. Then you've got to have martial law and totalitarian government here in the United States, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. And then in the cities, you've got to have repression in order to keep order. Well, it isn't good, but you know, that's what we want. That's what we're voting for. Every time we vote for one of these communist candidates, that's what we're voting for. It's the outcome. It's the natural outcome that comes from communism. It's always been that way in the past. It's that way today. I don't see any reason to expect that it's going to be any different in the future. So you might as well get ready for it, and you might as well be prepared for it. Now, it's in Deuteronomy 28, verses 53 through 58, and that's cannibalism. So that's what I'm expecting here. That's why I keep telling you, I can't think of a better business to be in than food and famine. So if you're looking for a new occupation, I think that food is it. Now, in Germany, there was no black market to speak of, if only because of the totally severe punishments distributed to those under-the-counter relations developed as described by Mr. Holloway. Having your shoe dealer sell you the rarer quality shoes instead of the sordid cheap ones. It became favor, applied to those who could reciprocate with other, not necessarily material, favors of their own. So let's suppose that you're the shoe store guy. And so, running the shoe store, the doctor comes in, and the doctor needs a pair of shoes. Well, now you got the common ordinary shoes, and then you got the good ones. So the doctor gets the good shoes, and he, in turn, is going to give you some medical favors. That's the way under-the-counter bribery is done, or favors are done, transmitted. Now, if you get caught, you know, black marketeering, you're taking your allotment of shoes, and then you're passing them out for profit and gain in a totalitarian society. And there, he says there was no black market to speak of. And Nick Minglin, when I asked him that very question, you know, about theft, you know, concerning the stealing of the salami, he said that was the only case that they knew of that happened in their town. And it resulted in the guy getting killed. And that was the end of that argument. Now, bribery went on and favors went on. There was that aspect of it, and you can expect that portion of it. Now, remember, there's about 200 things over here that are going to be rationed that you can expect. And that's in this country, Australia, Canada, the United States, New Zealand, anything important. And in fact, it may not even be rationed because it'll just be non-existent. So if it's non-existent, you don't need to ration it. So if you want to have it for your lifestyle, that's going to be tobacco. Not so much booze. In World War II, there was plenty of alcohol. In Russia, as tough as times are, there's no shortage of vodka. And it's cheap vodka, too. So tie that one on and see where that one leads. I'm not concerned about alcohol, although it might be a good idea to store a little. Now, one of the changes that many Americans made in their diet was the substitution of margarine for butter, dubbed poor man's butter before the war. Oleo became a staple on many Americans' tables to stretch real butter. People mixed it with light cream or top milk, custard or unflavored gelatin. Cottage cheese was often substituted for meat, and its sales exploded from 110 million pounds in the 1930s to 500 million pounds in 1944. Even Fido did his part by giving up his fresh table scraps for dehydrated canned dog food. Don't feed your dog precious table meat. Give him Red Heart, declared a magazine advertisement. It contains federally inspected meats and meat byproducts not ordinarily selected for table use, but good for your dog. Food manufacturers, I'll pause here for a moment. My daughter called one day and she was talking about her two dogs. And my wife said, well, you'll be killing those two dogs and eating them when this thing comes to a head. And my daughter didn't call back for a couple of months because, you know, being raised on Barney and Sesame Street, killing your dogs and eating them, you know, is just unthinkable. I mean, would Mr. Rogers do such a despicable thing as killing a dog and eating it? Well, in Stalingrad, you know, the time came when those people were eating grass, bark, they were boiling old leather shoes and then drinking the broth. I mean, come on, children, you know, when desperation sets in, people that are eating their children are going to eat their dogs and cats and squirrels and sheep and cows. I mean, when desperation kicks in, my neighbors, that is the poor people, they're going to come out here and they're going to shoot my cows in the middle of the night. And that's tragic. Because every time you kill a cow, you're depleting the raw material that you need to produce more cattle. When you kill a cow, there will be no more calves coming out of that cow. That's short term. But then short-term desperation produces short-term solutions, which is go out and kill Gordon's cow. Now, the cow weighs 1,000 pounds, so they can't just pick it up at 2 o'clock in the morning and pack it home. So they will cut out the prime cuts. They'll cut out the back straps and maybe one ham and let the rest of it go to waste. So here's a cow that could have fed, you know, a whole family for a year, is going to feed this whole family for maybe a month. And the rest of it goes to waste. And that's what you saw with Hurricane Katrina. When the people were breaking into the Walmart stores and looting them, they'd go in and they'd take, there was a woman in there. She took a package of Pampers, one package. I don't know why she didn't take six, while she was at it. She took one package. And then, for no intelligent reason, she took her hand and swiped about six or eight packages of Pampers off into the water. She's walking in knee-deep water in the store. And I looked at that and I said, now what in the hell kind of sense does that make? It was good that she rationed herself to just one package of Pampers. But why destroy six or eight more packages? Isn't there somebody else that's going to come by after you that could use those Pampers because the water wasn't up that high yet? People were looting the Walmart stores down near New Orleans. They were stealing television sets. There's no power. What in the hell are you stealing television sets where you're going to take them home to? A house that's already underwater by 11 feet? Stealing Cadillac automobiles and going around marauding around shooting people. What the hell is that all about? What has that got to do with subsistence and survival? What's that got to do with rationing? What's that got to do with reason, logic, or common sense? But that's the mentality that people degenerate into in the cities, and that's what you're going to have in the cities, and that's why you're going to have martial law. That's why you're going to have troops on the city corners or the street corners of your city, because the people just go nuts there. So if that's the place you want to hold up, well, okay, but get used to the idea that the police and the firemen and the soldiers that are there to keep order, because without it, you're going to degenerate into barbarism and anarchy. And hell, that's worse than the totalitarian government. So, you know, what happens here is you're going to be degenerating into poorer and poorer conditions in the cities as time progresses along. And so for openers, you know, I can really understand, you know, that soldier on the corner with his submachine gun, you know, when push comes to shove, he's got his orders and he's going to execute his orders. And yes, he will shoot Americans that are looting the Walmart store. I don't know that they will be leaving the bodies for 3 days for the maggots to infest. That might be a little bit draconian, but keep in mind that totalitarian government in the cities will be not only normal, it will be a prerequisite, it will be an essential to living there. You won't be able to live there without it. And when the electricity is shut off, without military occupation to enforce order, and without electricity, you know, without air conditioning, you people are going to go nuts. Now, food manufacturers here in America took advantage of wartime shortages to flaunt their patriotism. Swift and Company proclaimed in its ads for Treat, similar to Spam, meat is the material of war. Stokely's proudly announced it takes food to win a war. The Uncle Sam's fighting men are the best fed in the world. And we're proud to report that some part of every crop of Stokely's vegetables and fruits is being sent to the Allied forces. You can rest assured that they were all getting paid for it, just like Halliburton. Grocers indulged in a little flag waving of their own. A Saginaw, Michigan Kroger ad cautioned, don't waste your meat ration. Be sure to be safe at Kroger's. It also provided lists of food items and the points needed to purchase them. Porterhouse steaks at 39 cents a pound required 8 points. Rib roast only cost 7 points and 29 cents per pound. Fresh white fish did not require any points. So fish was available. Didn't have to have a ration to buy fish, but you did to buy red meat. Now, for those of you that don't eat red meat anyway, that may work out, but then I wouldn't count on that because I'm not so sure that people that are eating their sons and daughters are going to have unrationed fish, do you? I took that one away in your heart. Victory gardens were another way that the average citizen dealt with food shortages and contributed to the war effort. The U.S. government proposed them as a national food-growing effort, similar to the Liberty Gardens of World War I. The term victory garden dates back to the book entitled Victory Garden that was written in 1603 by Englishman Richard Gardner. Gardner argued if any city or town should be besieged with the enemy, what better provision for the greatest number of people can be than every garden to be sufficiently planted with carrots? All right, so going back to siege mentality that we see here in the Bible, Deuteronomy 28, remember when in the siege? Well, a siege is where you cut off supplies coming into the population. So it used to be the army would surround the city. Okay, well, inside the city it rains, and so you collect the rainwater off of the buildings and run it into cisterns. There's your water. Now, you all plant your victory gardens. Now, here in America, that's a wild concept. We Americans don't plant gardens. We plant useless grass. and then spend thousands of dollars fertilizing this grass so that we can have these beautiful lawns, which make no sense at all, but that's what we do. And that's because we're busy. Our schedule is just tied up watching Judge Judy and Oprah and Howard Stern. And we don't have time to plant victory gardens. But, you know, if there's no electricity and there's no TV, maybe you'll have more time. And I'll guarantee you that when you're hungry, it is not the time that you want to go out and work in the garden. So if you think I'm going to wait until I'm hungry and then I'm going to go out and work, hey, you got another guest coming there, son. Work is extremely unpleasant when you're hungry. But keep in mind, these victory gardens can produce all of the food that you need in your suburban area for your family of six. That's 2,000 square feet. Six beds, 6.5 feet wide, 60 feet long, laid out with railroad ties. Railroad ties. So there's a little thought for you. Now, this rationing, then, is the opposite to the Ten Commandments. If you want to practice the Ten Commandments and the Mosaic Law, you can probably sidestep rationing. That's what I'm doing. That's what I think is the better modality. But if you want to continue practicing the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto, you know, things like the abolition of all right to property and free education for all children and public schools and income tax and central banks and things like that, well, then rationing is going to be a part and parcel of your life, so you might as well get used to it and you might as well get the most out of it. All right, with that said, then, let me remind you that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 112 countries daily, worldwide, over the Internet and radio. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-profit, non-commercial, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has our radio log schedule and archives, and that can be accessed to the website as well at georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, our time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.